Wait, wait, stop. That's the one. Welcome to Zenten Speaks, a show where I make new friends and reconnect with old ones. A show where everyone's stories may inspire you to tell your own story. In this podcast, we encourage everyone to get rid of shame, guilt, fear, doubt, and judgments for themselves and for others, and replace those with love, empathy, compassion, understanding, kindness, and to do your best in everything that you do. In essence, to get rid of things that no longer serve your well-being, to be true to yourself and be honest with others. No need to be politically correct. That's out the window with 2020. Here, we tell the raw, uncensored story, your story, and tell the truth as you see it. Make sure you live your fulfilled life without permission or apologies. So, if you have a juicy, interesting, raw, unapologetic story and inspiring, please make sure to contact me at zenten21@gmail.com. It is zenten21@gmail.com. Or you can find me on most social media platforms. You know it, the IG, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, OnlyFans. I mean, not really, but yes, OnlyFans. Just kidding. Not. As you may guessed it, my name is Zen, and welcome to the show. Today we have a guest, and our guest is Gary Alt. Gary Alt is a former Jehovah's Witness from 1974 until 2012, serving at the New York Bethel headquarters and as an elder. Gary is currently a financial advisor and life coach. He is also a songwriter, musician, and author of the book Force of Will, which I will put in the description on below. And Force of Will can be found on Amazon. Furthermore, Gary has a FM radio show at KGPR, Great Falls of Montana. As Gary was disfellowshipped from being a Jehovah's Witness, through bravery and growth, Gary had combined his former experiences with more current and correct knowledge to create life coaching practices that helps other people in similar situation. Gary's story is very interesting one, so please help me welcome Gary Alt to the show. Welcome, Gary.
Thank you for having me.
Definitely, thank you for coming. I've always wanted to visit Montana. It's like a big state. Like, how is it? Are you in the mountains or something?
Right where I live, it's kind of flat. I'm in Great Falls, which is like the third largest city in Montana. Not that it's big, but it's like 60,000 people, but it's fairly flat. It's got some hills, but as soon as you leave town, you see these incredible mountains. And in fact, if you look across town, you can see them in the distance. It's really stupendous. I mean, the mountains I used to live in Pennsylvania, which is kind of hilly and a lot of trees and everything, but the difference is everything is kind of close in and you don't see for large distances. In Montana, you just see for miles because the mountains are in the background and there are these prairies and ranches and stuff in the foreground, and it's unbelievable.
Yeah, I bet. I've seen videos and photos, and I have a goal to, and of course, money is a stopper for a lot of things. Well, for some people, it's not. But my goal is to work in most major cities at least for 1 week in the whole United States. Yeah, because I would love to, you know, vacation, you go on vacation somewhere in a city, or let's say if I go to Montana in the larger city, but it's so big, it's like I don't see the whole thing. So I want to see the whole United States before I die eventually. That's a goal.
Wow.
Yeah, it looks huge, but I probably can do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. So please tell us a bit about who you are and what you do.
Well, you pretty much nailed it. I mean, there's a lot more to the story, obviously, but you know, I came into the organization when I was 15, baptized when I was 16. The year the world ended, actually, in 1975. you know, I stayed with it for 41-plus years, ever loyal, you know. I had an explanation for everything. You know, if somebody was wondering why the end was taking so long, I could explain it, you know. But then, you know, things kind of got out of hand, and, you know, I was no longer an elder for a period of time. I got reappointed as a ministerial servant, but then I wanted to reach out for more responsibilities, and that's when they really started putting the screws in, and it took me a while to realize that they were really just afraid of me, because I was like a challenge to them. I was like, because I made them look bad. I was doing shepherding and stuff that they never did, and I didn't always agree with the way they judged people and such. So basically what happened was my wife, who was, you know, probably still a stalwart JW, kind of got tired of me, like, bucking horns with the elders, and she didn't want that. So she basically put together a really cool plan to basically get rid of me. And so that's how I ended up getting out. Otherwise, I would probably still be in. I really believe that it, in most cases, it's some sort of a trauma. That it's not like, oh gee, I wonder, you know, is God's name really Jehovah, or are we really living in the time of the end? I don't think that's what gets people out. Typically, it's more something really went wrong, and it kind of forced you to kind of look at things differently. So that's what I did, and I was really out for almost 4 years before they actually had a committee put together. So I got used to the idea that the Brotherhood is a sham, because nobody was talking to me, and there was really no reason not to. It was just because they believed my wife. And so, you know, that kind of prepared me for life on the outside, and I think I bit off a little bit at a time and adjusted a little bit at a time, which was sort of a way of coping, I suppose.
Right. So you basically told the thing in a nutshell, but I will ask you some questions that you can more elaborate on that.
Sure.
So what made you join Jehovah's Witnesses to begin with?
Well, I was 15 years old at the time that I had started studying, and you know, none of my family ever was in. You know, they weren't at that time, and they never have been. But I just had a lot of questions about. Well, I mean, the Vietnam War was still going. You know, it was the year that the United States finally pulled out and Nixon resigned, but. But it was just this last couple of years, like 72, 73, I was just like, why is this world such a mess? Why do we hear reports every day of some of our boys dying or doing horrible things over in Vietnam? And just the whole meaning of life, I just couldn't get it. And I wondered about the condition of the dead and all those kind of questions. And I got my answers. A friend of mine that I'd known since I was 3 years old, he became a JW, his mother did, when he was really little, and he took me on a Bible study, actually, and then he asked me if I wanted my own study, and I said, absolutely. So the first thing I learned was the condition of the dead, the hope for the dead, God's name, and I was like, oh my God, I just, my eyes were just so opened, it was like unbelievable, and I just wanted to learn, and it didn't take me long to come to the conclusion that this is the truth. Which is the moment, the way I see it, that's the moment when the thought control starts.
Mm-hmm.
Because to me, because in my experience, it wasn't at all like, you know, mind control, emotional control, making decisions for people like you can't go to college. That just didn't happen where I came in. None of those things ever happened. I mean, in isolated situations it did, but for the most part, it just didn't happen that way. So I think that when I decided this is the truth is when, in my own mind, I kind of submitted myself to a high control kind of religion, because from that point on, the assumption is that not only is what I've learned so far the truth, but what everything I'm going to learn is the truth, because it all came from the organization.
Right.
problem comes in.
Right.
Or at least it did with me.
In our previous conversation, I love how you say, I don't look back with any bitterness, and I don't have an attitude of bring down the empire. So I think you saying that is a positive characteristic, but why is that you don't have a bitterness or a thing you want to bring it down and do all these things like many people in those groups are doing? Why is yours different?
Yeah, and I respect them for that. You know, that's fine, and because everybody's experience is different. But I made my own decisions, you know. I mean, I didn't go to college because I didn't want to go to college. It had nothing to do with the pressure from the elders or anything, or my family, because they weren't in. So I made my decision, and, you know, I got my education much later. But, you know, every decision I made was my decision. And the elders were pretty much, that's the way they were. They would say, if I asked them a question about should I do this or should I do that, what do you think? And they would say, Gary, you're 16 years old now. It's not really my job to make that decision for you. So let me show you how to do a little bit of research and this and that. So I made my own decisions. And so if I regret anything, if I'm going to be resentful or bitter, I'd have to be resentful or bitter toward myself.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Yeah, the organization is destructive. Of course it is, you know, and some people experience, people that were born in or that were abused or whatever. I mean, my heart goes out to them. It's a completely different experience for them. And I get it, because they don't really feel it, that they really ever had the power to do, you know, their own thing. But with me, it was my own decision. And, you know, for example, being shunned, I did the same thing. You know, anytime I heard somebody's name announced from the platform, I didn't necessarily know the story. And, you know, there were times when I kind of questioned it a little bit. But the basic idea is we're supposed to go along with the system. I was supposed to trust in the elders that they did the right thing. So I did.
Right.
And so I would treat people the way you're supposed to. You know, and not family members, of course, because that's going way overboard. But so how can I be upset with somebody for shunning me? You know what I mean? It's like, it doesn't make any sense.
Right.
So I think it's important to be grateful for the things that you can be grateful for. And in 40 years, I mean, my life was pretty much all in the JW organization. I mean, I did other things, obviously. I talked with other people and worked outside and everything. But for the most part, that was my life. So, obviously, there were good times. It wasn't all awful. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been there, you know. And so, you know, I'm grateful for some of the people I've met, some of the things I learned, you know. And as far as the things that are negative, that you know, I had to kind of readjust and relearn and kind of, you know, change my thinking over. So I did. You know, I just don't think that doing things in a resentful, kind of angry spirit is particularly healthy. That's a phase you might go through, which is fine. It's a phase. I don't mean a phase like in the sense that it has a beginning and an end, because it might recur every so often. But it's a normal thing to have anger, sadness, and things like that. It's because it's a mourning process we go through when we finally realize this wasn't the truth and all these people shun us and everything. But, you know, once I've moved beyond that, there's really nothing to be resentful for or angry about.
That is very beautiful, and I hope people listening to this who are hurt by everything else that happened to them and who are resentful hear this and they get inspired by it, because, and as you mentioned, a point that you mentioned, we've done all these things. And one thing, I don't like guilt or shame, but one thing I had guilt or shame about when I left willingly was shunning other people. And I knew it was wrong, but of course you get blinded and then you do it. And then when I was out and I said that was wrong and I went along with it, shame on me.
Yeah, right. And you know, the beautiful thing about that, it's just a personal experience, is I believe the first person I reached out to deliberately that had been disfellowshipped like 20 years prior or something like that was someone that had tried to reach out to me several times over the years via the Facebook Messenger thing, I guess. And every time she did, I thought, oh my God, she just doesn't get it. I can't believe how brazen she is to be trying to contact me. It's like, I thought, oh my God, she's an apostate, you know, which is the worst thing to be if you're
right.
A JW believer. once I was out, I said, you know, I'm gonna reach out to her, and we met, and she actually bought me lunch, and it was actually at a book reading that I did for my book, and she bought donuts and coffee for the book reading and everything, and she was so supportive, and I said, you know, I have to apologize to you because I kind of always thought that there must have been another story behind you being booted out, but I just accepted the story that we heard because you don't know what else to do. And I treated you, and she said, Gary, stop. It's not important. It's, you know, you did what you're supposed to do. I did the same thing when I was in, and I had four very similar experiences right in a row inside of that first year where I met with someone that I had shunned for decades or years or whatever. And I apologize to every one of them, and they all said the same thing. Gary, please stop. You don't need to apologize for anything.
Wow.
So that really taught me what forgiveness is really about, because when you think about it, the JWs don't know what it is.
Right. They often talk about it, but you're so right about that. They say, oh, we forgive, and God is forgiveness, but they don't forgive.
No. They
just say it.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. When you were talking about that, I got goosebumps. Like I can see it and feel it, and this is so powerful, and which also reminds me of the quote that sometimes when you in it, there was a story I remember a while back. They said these people, when they are in the sewage and then your nose is in there, you don't know how foul it is, but when you out and you can have a perspective, and it's the same thing with the shunning. It's like you going along with it, you're blind, and then you want to go. It's your livelihood, it's your life. And then once you're out and you can see the differenceness and how much it hurts and how much it sucks and how wrong it is. Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah. And you know, the other thing that taught me was, I mean, am I going to go back to, you know, apologize to everybody I ever shunned, even people that were considered bad association that you kind of shun halfway, you know, am I going to really go back to everyone? So what you basically learned to do, or what I learned to do, was to forgive myself.
Right.
You know, because I was ignorant, and I'm not making excuses for myself. But,
right.
But you have to forgive yourself, and you have to realize that you're basically a good person. Otherwise, you'll never get past all the shame and guilt that they put on you.
Right. And we make mistakes. And the most important thing is, I often tell, well, when I had partners, I would say it's not about the mistake, it's about moving forward. Can you see yourself moving forward? Because we all make a mistake, it's okay. It's you move on forward, doing better. Once you know better, you do better, like Maya Angelou says. But I wanted to bring a point about something you mentioned. Okay, so I do believe, and that's kind of controversial maybe, or taboo, and this is why I like this podcast, because I want to bring and anything anyone think about or talk about so people can talk about it. I strongly believe, regardless of being pressured doing something, we still have a choice, like the will to do something. So as you mentioned, like when we were in the organization, we were pressured doing something, but we still had the choice or the thinking, even if we were blurred or a slave to it and we were blind to it, we still had a choice to say, hey, was this wrong or not? And we still did it. Like, do you have the same thought process or differently?
Again, I think you have to take responsibility for your own thinking and the decisions you make. There were things that I always kind of had questions about, but I never felt that they were that important.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, I can just give you a couple of examples. Like when I studied the Revelation book, you know, before we did it in the book study, I did it in my personal study, and I learned that the trumpet blasts correspond to talks that Joseph Rutherford gave at conventions in 1920, whatever. And I thought, are you kidding me? I mean, really? This is what John was writing about? I mean, come on. And I studied it and studied it and studied it, and I could not make sense of it, but neither could I come up with a better idea. So I just thought, well, you know, everything they've taught me so far is true. I mean, that's what I thought anyway. And so this is probably right. And if it's not, they'll change it. But eventually I'll get it, you know. And I never did get it. And there are probably a couple of other things I could think of like that that weren't really important to me. Because I just thought, well, EJ, I'd really love to know what this is really about, but it doesn't really matter. It doesn't affect me. So, you know, I kind of, it's kind of willful ignorance, I guess, that because you just figure if everything that they say must be true, or will eventually be true as they make adjustments. And which is basically kind of I was kind of like ceding my thinking to them to some extent, but at the same time, I didn't just swallow hook, line, and sinker, you know?
Right. It's really beautiful and important before we go forward. How you are saying you've been in there for 40 years, so there must have been good times. And that's really important. And I've told that to past relationships or even people who've talked to once a relationship advice, I said, or even friendship or anything, even a job, if you're doing something, there's even one day, if it wasn't 40 years, but even one day, there must have been a day or a week or a moment of happiness or content or whatever it was, something good. And which brings into gratitude. I saw a quote that says gratitude is not about what you get. It's about living in the present and be grateful for what you have at the moment. Okay, so you kind of briefly mentioned if things did not happen the way it did, you probably would still be in there. So if what happened did not happen, that means you would not have critical thinking to get out of the organization? Like, can you tell me?
Yeah, I mean, I always considered myself an independent thinker. You know, I never bought the idea that independent thinking is evil. That's just a term that they made up. Obviously, we have our own brains, mm-hmm. and our own brain tells us when to breathe and when to beat for our heart to beat. And it also, you know, our conscious mind is our own mind. I mean, I can't understand that concept of independent thinking is evil, you know. But I would characterize it as, I don't know if this is a clinical term or not, but malignant optimism, where I was always optimistic in the sense that I thought things are as good as they can be right now, and they will get better.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how they're going to get better. I mean, I was always, when I was an elder, for example, I was always trying to get to change things so people could be treated a little bit more humanely, you know? And it just never happened. It did sort of happen when we had a complete shift in, you know, when the congregation split and all the bad elders went to one, and then we had all these Bethelites in our congregation, so things got a lot better. But it's still the same organization. It's still very judgmental and very rigid, and I didn't see that. I always made excuses for it. Like I said, I have an explanation for anything, like the whole new generation thing, the new definition of generation they came up with about 10 years ago or something.
Right.
I never understood that. I said it sounds ridiculous. I mean, I'm sure they're going to change this someday because it can't possibly be right. But I said, well, I'm not going to try to explain it to somebody. If I'm in the field ministry and somebody wants to know, how do you know we're in the last days, I'm not going to bring up the new definition generation because it's stupid. I mean, it's just completely idiotic and illogical and not even scriptural. But
right.
Since I didn't have a better explanation, I just thought, well, all right, someday they'll change it. We're still living in the last days. So that's where the, you know, malignant optimism comes in, or some people might just describe it as cognitive dissonance, but which I guess it is. But I think as much as we think that we're free thinkers, because in the organization you do have people that are completely sycophantic. They have no ability to think at all for themselves. I mean, I even remember an older woman in her 70s that once said, why can't the society just write an article that tells us which movies we can see and which ones we can't see? Wouldn't that make it easier? And she really thought that would be a great idea. So there are some people that really never use their brain for themselves. And there are some that do it a lot, but I don't think there's any witness alive that does it completely, that really does it in a true sense, because they'll always make excuses for the organization. It doesn't matter what you tell them. It doesn't matter what, how many stories they hear of, they'll dismiss it and say, oh, it's apostate-driven lies, you know?
Right.
So there's always an excuse for things. So I think that I was not any different from anybody else. I did quite a bit of my own thinking, and I always taught my kids that way. Do not cede your brain to someone else. It's your brain. Use it. But at the same time, I mean, to some extent, I made those excuses and kind of went along with things that really didn't make sense to go along with.
Right. And with the thinking, how they teach you thinking is for devil worshippers or Satan is getting into your mind. I started thinking maybe I got baptized. I don't remember exactly the age. You know, funny thing is, I don't know how you are with age right now, but I still struggle with timeline and age because I never celebrate birthday.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So my timeline can be like iffy. But I think I probably got baptized around 16, maybe. I'm not sure, but pretty young. But I left definitely at 19 and a half. I know that because I was in college then. And then because when you went to college, it's emphasized on your social security number and where you live and your age. So I had to learn my age around 19, which is crazy thing for people who not Jehovah's Witness to. Even like people who's not Jehovah's Witness or never heard of that, when I tell them about the age, they're like, how did you not know your age until you were 19? Well, I cannot explain it. It's just the way it was. Because I don't celebrate it. I don't think about it. I don't know my siblings' age. It wasn't that important. And so when I started having questions and I would ask the elders, because I was pretty zealous. I had a lot of hours in the field work and I was well known and I was like really into it. And I believed. But I had questions or things that did not make sense, especially with the contradiction of the last days of living. Because I'm like, well, it says not even Jesus knows. Then how do you, Jehovah's Witness, keep saying that you know? You're not saying, hey, I know, but you keep kind of presumingly. But then you're saying at the same time, you don't know. So make up your mind on that. So I would be asking the elder question, and it's funny. He was a dad to me. Like, we would preach together, and I miss him, really. Unfortunately, because we're Jehovah's Witness, so we cannot be together in a sense. But he was, like, my second dad. And I would ask him questions, and he would answer some questions or said, don't ask that, that's not good. But he was supportive in a way. But the other elders, they saw me as the devil because I asked questions. And that made it worse because I was so zealous. I was so into it. And I was I was like one of those children that were exemplary children to be friends with as a Jehovah's Witness. And how, because I becoming curious and you're saying it's the devil coming into my head. And I did not see it like that, obviously. And amongst other things, and the thing that did it for me was I started growing facial hair late, maybe around 18 or 19. I had like little stubbles, really. And I used to visit other organizations. You know how someone else visit another organization to make a speech or because they give you different privileges. And then the other elder in the other place said that I was worldly because of my appearance, instead of asking me questions or even instead of being supportive and say, hey, you look this way, I can teach you how, etc. Like being supportive. So he was very rude. And when I brought it up to my elder, he said, oh, I know you, so don't. And then my elder was supportive. He taught me. That's why I consider him as my father, because my dad did not teach me those things. And then he taught me instead of my dad, instead of that elder. So that made me more into thinking. So eventually, one day I just stopped going Kingdom Hall altogether, and then I changed my phone number, and that was it. And I never looked back, and I changed my phone number, and sometimes I would see them. I'm from Boston, so it's pretty small. So sometimes I would see them on the field service. I would just say hi and keep walking because I didn't want to be rude and or be weird, make it weird either, because I feel like if I love you, I love you forever, period. And it, that does not change the circumstances.
Right.
And as for them, and that I feel secretly they have, they feel the same way, but they feel like they're not allowed to, and they're, or else they will be shown as well. It's like a survival thing, I feel.
Yeah, that's very true. I'm sure there are probably witnesses that wish that they didn't have to do that, but yeah, it's a threat. It's a control thing, that way of keeping evil out, supposedly. That if you talk to them, then you could be next, you know.
Right.
It's really horrendous. And it, you know, I don't think it was quite that way years ago, at least not in my circles, but they've really, really tightened it up, and they've got, it seems to me that they're like on their last legs trying to rein everything in, because it's getting so out of hand, it's getting out of their control.
Right.
So, yeah.
That's what I'm reading on those groups. It's, the shunning is out of control.
Yeah, it's really gone ballistic. So, I really get the sense that they're dead. And I'm not trying to make any predictions about the future of the organization. For all I know, they'll be around 50 or 100 years from now. It doesn't really matter to me. I don't concern myself with it. It's just as much as I don't concern myself with the Catholic Church or Islam or the Republican versus the left, Democrat Party. Those things are going to exist whether I like it or not.
Right.
And I don't worry about it. I got too much to worry about, you know? But,
right.
But it just seems to me on the surface that the way they've been using the internet, and, you know, up until fairly recently, it was like, oh, be careful about using the internet, and we shouldn't really be using social media because it was going to open up the world to the people. But now they're using it abundantly, and so how do you have people use it? And, you know, when somebody does a Google search and says, yeah, I don't know, whatever, they just might look Jehovah's Witnesses Assembly or something because they think they're going to find out where the next assembly is or something, and they find a website that has contrary views. You know, how do you contain that? So now you have all this news out there about, so it's not even so-called apostate websites. It's credible news sources,
right,
that have story after story after story in every country in the world, almost, you know. And at some point, the cat's out of the bag, in other words, you know. So I think they're just trying to tighten up their controls, and the more you tighten up, the more things slip through your fingers.
Right.
So, I don't know. But like I said, I don't make predictions because it doesn't really matter, and I'm probably going to be wrong anyway.
Yes, so true. I am not. I spoke to a group leader on Facebook, Ex-Jehovah's Witness group, and he's pretty involved with all this stuff. But he calls. I'm a voyeur, as in, like, I watch all the groups and I don't make comments and I don't make my own things. I just, like, watch how different people behave out of the organization. And in the beginning, though, when I seek those groups out, whenever I make a comment, because as you are, I'm not bitter and I'm not mad about things. I left willingly and I have no opinion and I don't care because I left it behind. It's their prerogative, whoever does it. So when I'll make a post or a comment like that, people were out for me. They DM me bad things, and I got kicked out of so many groups because of it. So now I learned my lesson to just read and watch and don't make comments and don't engage with apparently different opinions. There's a witch hunt. Like, people cannot have different opinions and still have a conversation. So I learned about that. So question for you regarding that. How engaged are you with other XJWs, if you are?
Well, I'm in several Facebook groups, but obviously I don't actually know most of those people in person. In my town, I mean, there's my girlfriend, who's, you know, obviously we're intimate, and then there's one other gentleman that lives not too far away from me, and then, you know, Montana is such that the next town is like about an hour and a half away. It's not like where I grew up in New York, where it's like you get in your car and you drive 5 minutes and you're in the next town. Another 5 minutes, you're in the next town, you know, whatever.
Right.
So there are scattered XJWs here and there that I'll say, hey, we should get together, but they're like 3 hours away. Like, when's it going to happen? I don't know. I stay engaged in these groups mainly because I see a lot of people that are hurting.
Mm-hmm.
And are really struggling to make their way. And as a life coach, I can help those people. And so that's really why I stay engaged. There's a lot of diversity with people with experience and maturity and progress levels and things like that. You know, there are some things that I just, you know, I don't, like, I just, you know, there are some groups that are really very negative. I'm not even part of those groups anymore. That's like, you know, it's been, they were bad experiences. So I just, you know, like, XJWs are the same as JWs, the same as Catholics, same as atheists. We're all different people. Everybody's got a different viewpoint, different belief system, different, you know, propensity for shoving things down people's throats versus, you know, live and let live kind of attitude.
Right.
That's just the way it is, you know. So I choose to associate with who I choose to. But I think my main interaction with XJWs is through the groups, because I don't really know that many in person.
Yeah, same here. There, of course, because it's New York, there's a lot of XJWs who actually are living here, because I think there's a XJW New York group too. And I wanted to meet some, but because of time or people busy or whatever, that didn't happen. But there's also like a barbecue every July 4th. I think there's a guy named Jimmy, and they have XJW gatherings together, but that's in Philly that they do it. But a lot of them are in New York, Connecticut, Philly, Delaware, or Jersey. And I often wanted to do it, but because I work or the schedule, etc. But as of now, because of my experiences with a lot of, I think especially the negative groups, that I just feel afraid. Because my opinions, I live and let live, and I love to talk to people who have different opinions, because it makes my mind more open instead of just like agreeing with a group, like I've done Jehovah's Witness, and there's no bigger thinking. So, but when I express, I often find myself lost or alone, because people will be like, I'm a witch hunter, and they witch hunt me. So now I just ask questions so I can hear people speak instead of like saying my own. That's like a different way of interact now. So how did you feel about being kicked out of Jehovah's Witness? Do you still have trauma from that, or how have you overcome being kicked out?
Well, I didn't want to be. I mean, at the time, I still felt it was the truth, even though I was treated miserably, and I mean, basically had no interaction with any JWs except maybe one of my kids, and that was sporadic and awkward. But I still felt it was the truth, so I wanted to stay connected. I knew I was never going to go back into a kingdom hall at a certain point, but I still felt that this is the truth, you know. So I fought it, and I went through the committee thing, and I went through the appeal process, really for one reason. It was just because I knew that if I didn't do everything I could to stay connected, that I would regret it for the rest of my life. If I did everything I could and they kicked me out because of their corrupt thinking and their just plain evilness, really, then there's nothing I can do about it, and I did what I can do, and at least I can sleep at night, you know. So, and that related mainly to my kids. I don't really care about almost anybody I ever met, because they dumped me, you know, like 3-4 years before I was ever in front of a committee. They dumped me based on a ridiculous story there was so much proof that the story was not true, nothing to prove that it was true, absolutely nothing, completely made up in someone's mind. And I mean, every kind of evidence you can imagine, eyewitnesses and just scores of people and documents and cameras and all kinds of things to prove unequivocally that the story that was made up was just utterly untrue. But all these people believed it. So I realized pretty quickly that I'm never going to get through to them. So they don't matter to me.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really just my kids. So So being kicked out, and I say kicked out because I don't like to use the word disfellowship. That's what it was. I was disfellowshipped. It's not an evil word, but I don't think of myself as in a disfellowshipped state. I have no status with that organization. It's like I've been out of my high school for 40 years, so that's where I graduated from. But I'm not on detention. I'm not in Mrs. Reiner's French class anymore. It's an old thing.
Right.
So it's the same thing with the witnesses. I am not in a disfellowship state because it's only Jehovah's Witnesses that think about me that way. And I'm not part of that organization in any way. So how am I disfellowship from, like, if I went to the store and said, "Hi, how you doing?" And he said, "Oh, how are you doing?" I said, "Well, okay, except that I'm disfellowship." They'd look at you like what? You know, I mean, it's just Jehovah's Witnesses that look at you that way. So what? So I don't think of myself that way. So it was an event. It's something that happened. It's like being arrested and then being let go. You're not in jail 20 years later. You were arrested. Okay, great. You know, now you're free. So it's the same thing. It was not traumatic because I was an elder and I saw how corrupt their thinking was and how they were. Basically, the reason I was disfellowshipped was it was just something that I didn't do, and I could prove that I didn't do it, but they weren't interested in the proof. And so they were just dishonest about it. They clearly wanted me out, you know.
Right.
I saw what was happening.
They couldn't wait.
Yeah. So I'm not going to get out of this. There's just no way. So it was not traumatic because I saw the handwriting on the wall, and I just said it is what it is. And I actually felt a sense of freedom when I was. It was about a two and a half hour drive home from where they met with me because they get to stay home and. Go to the Kingdom Hall around the corner, but I had to drive like 2+ hours, you know. So I was remarried at that point to a woman that had nothing to do with the witnesses, and I remember driving home thinking, I am finally free. They have no power over me anymore at all. They can't call me and ask me to go to a meeting. I can just hang up on them. I don't have to answer their calls. They have absolutely no influence on my life ever again.
Nice.
That was so freeing. So was that traumatic? Well, no, it wasn't. Now, of course, I was, you know, when I would think about what it meant for my relationship with my kids, it's very sad, you know.
Mm.
But that's a work in progress. You go through a mourning period, and I think it's important to recognize it as mourning because it's a loss that you can't really do a whole lot about. It's just like if somebody dies, you can't bring them back.
Right.
You go to their funeral and you mourn with everybody. And it's something you just have to adjust to, and life goes on. It doesn't mean you're not going to have a bad day when you think about them later in life, you know. But life does go on, and it's the same thing. It's different in that there are things that some people have done that have helped, you know, like they've maintained contact and things like that. But it's very rare. For the vast majority of us, there's really nothing you can do about it because their thinking is their thinking. And you can't change the way they think. All you can do is change the way you think.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of my biggest things when I talk to people in the life coach practice is that all we can really change is our thinking. Because when we change our thinking, we change our emotions.
Yes.
Because an emotion can't exist unless we're thinking about something and it's in our mind, it's true, like something about ourselves, you know, something that happened today that convinces me that I'm a bad person. That's my thought, my erroneous thinking that I'm somehow a bad person because of what just happened today. So I have to change that thought and therefore the emotion changes, you know. So it's a mourning thing, you know. We get angry, we get sad, we go through a period of shock and disbelief. And maybe we get angry again a couple of years later when we think about it. Those are normal things. There's nothing wrong with being angry or sad about something. But we do have to change our entire belief system, and that's what's going to get us back into a state of emotional wellness. So I don't think of it as traumatic. It's just something that happened.
That's a right way of thinking about it and feeling it and doing it. Definitely, and that's a path to healing, and I love it. And I felt the same, similar ways too, because when I left, my circumstances are kind of different because I did not, I will have a solo podcast about that, with about friendship. I was not allowed to make friends outside the organization, of course, and not even within, because I was considered to them those exemplar children. So I couldn't make friends with people they thought that were not good enough, kind of a thing, if that makes sense. And I could only make friends with elder children or the other, what's under the elders?
Ministerial servants?
Yes. So I could only make those friends. So I didn't have much friends. So when I left, I kind of left it that way because I'm like, well, it is that. And my family, although I was not brought up by my parents entirely, not even half of my life, I would say, for 5 or 6 years of my life, that's when I met my parents, and that's when they raised me for that part of my life. So I did not have that deep of a connection with them. And so when I left, I had really no sense of loss, which was pretty weird for a lot of, even for me, I was thinking, I was like, am I that cold that I don't feel anything? As I grew older, I'm thinking maybe because I did not have a connection with many people. So when I lost them, they weren't even lost because I had no connection. And I don't have children within it, etc. Even my siblings, who some of them were still Jehovah's Witness, I think the only people that I miss were my siblings. But after a point, I realized, well, they made their choice to shun me. So what can I do? I just have to move forward and live my life to the fullest.
Exactly.
So how's your relationship with your children? Are they Jehovah's Witness or?
Yeah, they all are. They're all in. And so I have three kids, girl, boy, girl, and they're all in their 30s. From the beginning of this, my son was always willing to talk, but and I don't want to get him in trouble. You know, if any like spies are listening, the fact is that he hasn't talked to me anymore. So, you know, that's pretty much it. But from the beginning, when I was being shunned and even treated differently by my daughters, to one a little differently than the other, way before the committee thing, you know, it was awkward with him. He actually tried to help, you know, because I needed some assistance because I basically had no place to live. It was all the circumstances were in the book. I basically had no place to live. I had no way to get into the house to get some change of clothes and, you know, things like that. And it just goes on and on and on. So he helped quite a bit, but it was very, very awkward. And, you know, efforts in recent years to say, hey, why don't we get together and just have lunch or something like that, and has always been like, yeah, let's do that. But then it never happens. And the next thing you know, I'm moving to Montana. And it's like, if we're going to get together, it's got to be in the next couple of weeks. And it's sort of like, yeah, well, I'll get back to you in a couple of weeks. Like, basically mm-hmm. what you're telling me is you don't want to meet with me. You know what I mean? So the girls, it's just, one of them had a baby not too long ago. And I sent a little, you know, a box full of clothing for, you know, 3-month-old, 6-month-old, and 12-month-old. And, you know, I got a little thank you note. And then the next thing I just said, hey, I'd like to visit with your grandparents because they can't make the trip. They're 88 years old. They can't make the trip. And we just want to visit and I'll stay in a hotel or something, you know. And I got a very, very negative, dehumanizing, completely dispassionate, you know, no emotion kind of answer that was like right out of the JW textbook.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized at that point that, you know, they're not bad kids. It was right out of the textbook. Some elder probably told her what to say.
Right.
It was completely, there was nothing human about it, nothing emotional about it. It was just matter of fact, like, please limit your contact to just essential things. Well, what's essential? Essential is my mother dies. And you need to know where the funeral is. Anything essential is going to have to do with death or serious illness. So essential, I'm not going to go there. So you know, it's not like it's not essential that I go to see my granddaughter. That's not, you know, it's only essential that I tell you that my mother died or something, you know. So it's pretty much no contact at this point. And, you know, the only way for that to change is for their thinking to change. And the only way for their thinking to change is for them to leave the organization, really, because like we said before, it's ironclad. You can't break the rules and expect to stay in.
Right.
And is it reasonable to expect them, their thinking to change? I have to go back to myself when I was in, like 10 years ago. What would have made my thinking change if my friend Stacy that I was talking about before, you know, contacted me again and said, Gary, really, it's not nice that you're treating me the way you are. My thinking's not going to change. I'm a JW. I'm a loyal JW. I know she's wrong. She's evil. She's in Satan's world, and I'm a Jehovah's world. You know, so it's not reasonable for me to expect my kids to really come around unless they completely leave, and I don't even know how that would happen.
Well, that is very inspiring to hear, and is very beautiful. And I hope people listening to this will take it to that to account, because I've noticed in most people, not everyone, of course, because I'm totally not like that. When something happens, they know what happened to them. They know the other side, and they still expect others to behave differently when they knew when they were there they would not. So hearing that is awesome, because you have empathy. So how have you progressed in your life now? Like, what's going on in your life right now?
Well, right now it's great. I mean, the last year was like the worst year of my life, and that was, you know, well after I left the JWs. It had nothing to do with them. It was just a bunch of things that happened that were just like oh my God, it just took the wind out of my sails every time you turn around. But then things started to come together just about a year ago, around the time that I moved to where I live now, and I met my life partner at this point, my girlfriend. And it's just remarkable. And it's not necessary that we meet the right person, because we should be able to be happy on our own. So I'm not saying that's the miracle solution.
Sure.
But it's been working out. Well, she's actually a counselor, a therapist, and she specializes in mental health and you know, several areas. And she's an ex-JW too.
Oh.
She's taught me a lot, just in my life coach practice, because I'm not a therapist, I'm not licensed to be a therapist, but I deal with people all the time that are really hurting, you know, and I try to not be a therapist, but apply the things that I've learned over the years, and we're always talking about things, and I've learned so much from her, and it just doesn't stop, because she's always going to know more than me about, you know, therapy and mental health and psychology. And I've studied a lot. I mean, even when I was an elder, I used to read books on psychology and psychiatry, and I used to apply that to the way I dealt with people. But so that's going really beautifully. And you know, music is it's a big part of my life. It always has been. And I just don't hold back. I mean, you know, like anybody, I've got a day job, and I can't just pick up a guitar anytime I feel like it and, you know, do whatever I want to do, because the reality is I got to make a living. But, you know, whenever I can, I'm going to hear music and going to play and doing writing songs and things like that. So I've just got so many things I do that there's not a lot of, well, there is a lot of spare time. You know, we do a lot of physical activities. I went to the gym this morning. We do kayaking. We go biking, you know, this and that. But in terms of, you know, so I'm not saying like you hide reality by being super, super busy like a workaholic.
Mm-hmm.
But I've just got enough things that are important to me that I'm always busy with, that, and especially helping people, which is probably one of my biggest messages to people that are trying to recover.
Right.
Is that at some point it's really, really critical. I mean, it's absolute. I don't think, I think I would say necessary. That you do something to reach out to other people in your community, volunteer, do something, whether it's, you know, helping the homeless or working at a soup kitchen or whatever. I mean, I started out when I was first out of the organization. I started out working at a radio station, just helping them answer phones during fundraisers. And there were other things that I supported. Like there was a women's resources group that I've helped a lot. But in terms of giving my time, I spent a lot of time with the radio station. Well, what does that have to do with curing cancer or helping the homeless? Well, nothing. But it's the arts, and it is a charitable kind of a business, and it changed my life, you know, because I love music so much. It's so important to me. So, in one way or the other, I just think it's good to give back to the community in some way, which will help. You know, you mainly do it because you want to help somebody else. You don't do it because you know it's going to be good for you. But guess what? It is.
Yes. It's great. Yes.
You're going to meet people. You're going to make friends with people that have the same interests and the same passion about what's really, really important to them. And they're going to be giving people, because if somebody's volunteering for something, not making a dime, that is a giving person. That's somebody you want to know.
Right.
So that's one of my main messages with the people that are struggling making friends, and they don't know what to do with themselves, and you know, even people that have economic problems because they bought into the mantra that, you know, you shouldn't go to college and you should be a loser and, you know, this and that.
Mm-hmm.
And all these years later, they're struggling. They're like, oh my God, I'm never going to be able to retire. And why do I have to live the way I do? And this and that. Well, it's difficult. It's difficult. I mean, the world is difficult. It's not just because you were JW. The world is the difficult place. And you know what? If you do volunteer work, again, this is not the reason to do it. If you're doing it for this reason, it's a mistake. But what sometimes happens is somebody sees the way you work with the dedication that you've got, and you're doing it for nothing. And before you know it, somebody offers you a job to do this or that. And they say, hey, you know what? With your skill set, I'm sure you can do this. So there's so much potential for benefit in just volunteering your time, helping others on an individual basis, on an organizational, institutional basis, giving back to the community with your time. I can't emphasize that enough. That's really, really important to do.
100%. I read a book. I don't remember the author, but it says How to Make Friends and Influence Others. And
I think it was, yeah.
Yeah. And one of the passage, that was the longest book ever, but one of the passage, she says, how to cure depression. And that's another taboo topic. When I bring that up on Facebook, people get so offended. But I think if they go past their offense and actually see what I'm saying or even read the book, then they will see the practicality of it. It says, the way you treat others is how you treat yourself. So basically, when you volunteer, like you were saying, yeah, you do it for others, but it feels good for you as well. So it's like two birds with one stone kind of a thing. So the book says if you're depressed, go and help someone else who's depressed. Then you're going to be out of your depression. It's kind of like, yeah, you're doing it for goodwilling, but it's also a strategy. It's like both. And then how to meet other people, you volunteer and then you do something good. And then other good things will come out of it. Maybe friendship, maybe a job, or maybe you'll heal your mental illness or whatever it is. And that's 100% correct. And I love it. And so can you tell us about your book, Force of Will?
Yeah, first of all, if you're looking for it, that is the title. But don't look under my name. The name of the author, it's me, but I use the pseudonym Tan Swiftwater. So look for Force of Will, Tan Swiftwater. And the reason for that is because it's a novel based on a true story. So, you know, there are composite characters that are compressed conversations. You know, it's all true. The basic facts of it is all absolute truth. But there are things that, like, well, you know, from the beginning, I kind of had a pretty good idea of the timeline, but it got to a point where I said, you know what, I don't remember where this conversation happened, and so I kind of made up a place, you know. But some of the characters, you know, that it's possible that somebody could say, well, I think he's talking about me. So I wrote it using a pseudonym.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I eventually realized that no JW is ever going to read this book anyway, because right from the first chapter it mentions a therapist talking about how his specialty is helping JWs with their unique needs. so I don't really care who, you know, in this group that hears me say that, that Tam Swiftwater is the same as me. But basically, it's my story of about 4.5 years of my life, right up to the point where I was finally disfellowshipped, and the aftermath of that, you know, how freeing it was and how life started to really get good at that point. And it's, I think there are several, you know, sub-themes of it, but one is that the incredible things that happened from the very beginning, it's like in chapter 3 or 4, it starts to get this incredible roller coaster thing, could not have happened if not for the fact that we were JWs, my wife and I were JWs. It never, ever would have happened, any of it. Her plan that she came up with to get rid of me would have been ridiculous. Nobody would have come up with the same thing. Nobody would have believed the story if they weren't JWs, because they just tend to believe anything somebody, like in a car group, says, you know, that well, you know, Gary's not at the meetings. Well, why not? And then his, all of a sudden his wife says, because of this, this, and that. Well, they're going to believe it because she's at all the meetings and she makes comments at the meetings and she turns in a field service report and Gary's nowhere to be found, you know?
Right.
So it's a story of how a ridiculous set of circumstances could only have been possible because of the JW organization.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't really get into their doctrines. In fact, by the end of the story, you might say, like, well, what's the deal with this guy? I mean, I know he's out, but does he still believe it's the truth? And the fact is, when I wrote the book, I did. I still did believe it was the truth, but I was whittling away, you know? So it doesn't really get into doctrines. In fact, there's some points along the way where I'm always almost defending the witnesses to people. But that sort of erodes, and at the end of the story, you can see where the attitude is, like, why I'm so glad I'm out, you know? So that's essentially what it's about, is it starts out with the fact that I was an FM radio DJ, and the whole plan that she came up with was impossible to believe. If you just listened to the radio for a minute, you would have known that this guy couldn't have been where she said he was when all this stuff happened. And, you know, but the witnesses don't know that because they don't listen to the radio. You know, they didn't. So that's it in a nutshell, I would say. Mm-hmm. It's about recovery and discovery. It's not about, you know, oh my goodness, this poor guy, like, when is he going to get a break? It's not about that. It's about how I basically said, okay, I've been dealt a really, really bad deck of cards. In fact, I was dealt no cards, you know, or I was dealt like 52 death cards, you know.
Yeah.
And like, what do I do about it, you know? And I just decided that, well, I guess I could roll over and play dead, but I don't even know how to do that because I'm still breathing. You know, even though I'm homeless at the moment and I don't have a job and can't get a job because of what she did, I'm still breathing, so I guess I'm not dead yet, so what am I going to do, kill myself, you know? So it was about recovery, about taking one day at a time and not worrying about what I can't do, the things I don't have power over, just worrying about the things that I can do and what is it I can do today. Not what can I do next week or the month after that. What can I do today? It might be the simplest little tiny thing, just getting $20 to put gas in the car, or maybe getting a bag of food that'll hopefully, if I put it in the freezer, it'll last me a month. You know, that type of thing. It was just about just surviving every day, one day at a time, and along the way, getting past the whole JW experience, but also discovering why things happened the way they did. Like, why did my wife come up with this idiotic idea, and why did everybody believe it? And, you know, so that's what it's about. It's about recovery and discovery.
Wow, amazing. So do you still believe or not? Like, what has changed within you?
Well, my belief system is that when I finally, I knew for quite a while that there was a lot that they do that's completely wrong and unchristian, just whacked out stuff, you know. But doctrinally, I still thought that they're basically right, except that, you know, their definition of generation has to change, you know, things like that. But sometime, I guess about 2 years after I was finally kicked out, I just finally said, you know, I'm going to do a little research. It's about time I did it. Just for the heck of it. And frankly, I was really trying to prove that the witnesses are correct, because I really wanted to believe that. taught about, and by the way, I was at Bethel just like the same year that he left, but so we never crossed paths because I came in October, and I think he left about a year before that, I guess, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I heard all these ridiculous things about him, and then he finally writes a book, and it, and everybody's telling you how evil that book is, but nobody's actually read it.
Right.
So I was trying to prove to myself that he is an evil apostate and that the JWs are basically right about everything. Well, little by little, I started to realize, like, oh, my God, they're wrong about this, they're wrong about that, they're wrong about this. And I finally got to the point where I knew enough to realize that, that they do not have the truth. So they might be right about this, this, and that, because I don't think anybody's wrong about everything. Even the Catholic Church is probably right about something, you know?
Right.
I use the Catholic Church because that was the biggest bugaboo. We always thought that that's the embodiment of evil. The
Babylon.
The core of Babylon the Great, the head, you know? You know, everybody's right about something, you know? And I thought, well, what's the difference? What's the difference if they're right about, you know, God's name or the condition of the dead? Whatever, it doesn't matter because they still don't have the truth, so there's no reason to worry. So I just decided I'm not going to go on an endless Bible study, you know, thing to find out, well, what is the real truth about the dead? Because it doesn't matter to me. I don't care. So my beliefs are basically that I still believe in a creator, and I use the name that we always used, you know, on occasion, because that's the best thing we can come up with in English. I just don't associate it with that organization. If anything, they blasphemed it like crazy with all their using that name as part of their name.
Right.
I mean, it's like holy mackerel.
Right.
But, you know, so when I look out at the mountains in Montana, I don't think they just got there. I just have a very high appreciation for everything around me. Apart from that, I don't know what to believe. Are we living in the last days? What's the difference? what am I going to change it or something? Like, you know, am I going to like turn the clock back or something? It doesn't matter. I find so much purpose in living each day, just doing good for other people and loving the people I love. That what's the difference whether there's something called Armageddon coming in 50 years or 200 years? Like, what? How does that? You know, so I'm not afraid of it. And I totally recognize that everybody has their own beliefs. There are some people that are atheists. There are some people that, you know, praise Jesus, this and that. That's fine. I respect everybody's beliefs. That's fine. But my beliefs are just that. I believe what I believe, and I don't think it matters, because I'm pretty sure that whatever happens in the future, whether it's after I'm dead or whatever, it's probably going to be good if you're a good person.
Definitely. I agree 100%. And I live my life in a very similar way, and that's very healthy. That's great. So how can someone reach out to you with your coaching?
Well, I have a website called Open Path Life Coach. So openpathlifecoach.com. My contact information is on there. You can send an email, you can call me, whatever. And one thing I need to mention is that I'm a life coach, not just for ex-JWs or ex-high control group people. I'm a life coach for... Basically, I just don't do couples therapy. That's about it. Other than that, it's like if you're changing jobs. I've coached people that wanted to lose 20 pounds, and I've coached people that wanted to start a not-for-profit company that's international that helps young children that are candidates for suicide, kids as young as 8. So I'm like, I can help somebody that's trying to lose 20 pounds, or I can help somebody who's trying to put together a company like that. It's really a really wide range of things that I do. And I specialize in high control group, ex-high control group people. So there is a page on there about, you know, how to sign up for sessions, and there's a pricing scheme and everything. I can't really say this on my website because it would not be fair, but it doesn't apply to XJWs. It's something, you know, we could talk about it, but it's not, I don't even remember what it is for, like, career-changing people, but it doesn't apply, and it's not the same thing, because I totally recognize that XJWs are, one of the things they have to overcome is that they were always taught to be a financial failure, to not, you know, go to college or not get a decent job, just be a you know, just do something menial, which is fine, by the way. I'm not being critical of anybody that That's what you do. That's great. But there's a lot of people out there that are struggling because they're like, oh my God, all of a sudden I need money and I don't know how I'm going to retire. So I'm not going to charge a whole ton of money for people that are in that kind of circumstance. So just so you know, when you go to the website, that doesn't apply. That's something we need to talk about. So again, openpathlifecoach.com.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Gary, for this conversation. And I learned a lot about your business and your different ways of XJWs think. And I really appreciate your time and conversation because I think it's really important for people to have conversation with different. I thought XJWs witnesses were the same experience that I've had. And when I went to the groups, I discovered it's a vast amount of differentness. So I appreciate you so much for sharing that differentness with me and everyone else.
Yeah, thank you. I enjoyed some of your expressions about your journey, and thank you for having me on.
Definitely. Have a good one. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Bye-bye. Bye.